Welcome to episode number 10 of Tech Talk today on WCCR 94.5 LPFM, live from the beautiful campus of University of the Cumberlands in Williamsburg, Kentucky. Triple T provides you with the latest news in the tech world and our opinions of what it all means. I'm Justin Hensley.
And I'm Kurt Lawson. Let's get Triple T started with this week's Tech Roundup. One of my favorite topics, security vulnerabilities. In this case, Apple confirms iOS backdoors, but calls them diagnostic capabilities. Apple acknowledged that its iOS operating system for iPhones and iPads contains several previously undisclosed, quote-unquote, diagnostic capabilities. These are services that an iOS forensics expert recently described as backdoors that could allow broad access to a user's personal data. On those devices under certain circumstances. Let's see, this is a pretty long article, but Jonathan Zdziarski works for me.
You just like finding articles with people's long names, don't you?
I do. Okay. He's a forensics expert who is also a one-time iOS jailbreaker and the author of several books on iPhone development. Zdziarski gave a presentation on his findings last weekend and published a slide deck to his talk. Slide deck, interesting. Just skipping down a little bit, he names these, I guess they're sections of code, com.apple.mobile.pcapd. It supports diagnostic packet capture from an iOS device to a trusted computer. This is useful for troubleshooting and diagnosing issues with apps on the device as well as enterprise VPN connections. Another one is com.apple.mobile.file_relay. Basically, supports limited copying of diagnostic data from a device. Service is separate from user-generated backups. This does not have access to all data on the device and respects iOS data protection. Apple Engineering uses file_relay on internal devices to qualify customer configurations. Apple Care, with user consent, can also use this tool to gather relevant diagnostic data. And the one that actually scares me a little bit is com.apple.mobile.house arrest, used by iTunes to transfer documents to and from iOS device for apps, support this functionality. This is used by Xcode to assist in transfer, and this can be done without knowledge of the user and without consent. Hmm. What Apple is saying is, this isn't a bug, it's a feature. And they're saying, you know, this is actually for testing purposes for, like, code and for back-end between different apps from the way I'm reading this. So there's a whole lot to read here for Zdziarski. And more than likely, Apple will just say, this is not a big deal. There's nothing to fear. Go on about your day. Or they'll maybe renege and patch on it. I don't know.
So kind of along the lines of what we were talking about last week with Android. And,
oh, yeah.
I think I actually said last week, I said, when are we going to start to see people exploit bugs in iOS? And so this is the way that they would exploit your iPhone. These three things that Kurt mentioned, this PCAPD and file relay and house arrest section of the iPhone code, the iOS code that's written in Xcode, it provides people with a knowledge of the code, a way to hack into the phone in ways that we might use it on an everyday basis. So, you know, this stuff is, like Kurt said, is pretty scary. I mean, again, you have to be careful what you have on your phone, what you have on your mobile device, whether it be an iOS, iPhone, or, Android device. Keeping passwords out there, that's not secure. Keeping personal data out there, it's not secure.
Right.
It can be hacked. It's just, it's a computer. So, interesting stuff here that this guy came up with. And, it's been out there for a long time, and it's good that people are showing this stuff. The problem is when they show it, if it's not patched, then it's going to be exploited.
Yeah. One thing I probably should have read here, File Relay has access to 44 data sources within an iPhone, including highly personal information as call records, SMS text messages, voicemail, GPS logs, and more. Don't know what more means, but I'm sure it's any other. It sounds like it's 44 data sources. That's a whole lot of pieces of information. So it says this information is little in common with diagnostic data in most cases, but hopefully they will.
They'll patch this. They should be coming out with some, hopefully iOS 8 takes care of this, and hopefully they come out with a patch for 7 before then.
Usually Apple's really serious about security. So you're absolutely...
I hope so. Extreme Tech article about solar panels suffer from two fundamental problems that have continued to persist even after decades of research. They're not very efficient, and they cost a lot to produce. At least one of these problems can be solved before solar power, at least one of these problems has to be solved before solar power can overtake cheap energy sources like fossil fuels. Some scientists have their hopes pinned on common minerals like perovskite. This is an organometal with peculiar light-absorbing properties, and a team of researchers from the University of Sheffield said that they figured out how to create high-efficiency perovskite. That's the way I would pronounce it. It's a organometal, perovskite. They create these highly efficient perovskite solar cells with a spray painting process. So spray on solar panels. Perovskite is a crystalline organometal made mostly of calcium titanate and is found in deposits all over the world. It was first discovered about 150 years ago, but only recently scientists have started investigating it as using its use as a solar panel semiconductor replacement for silicon. It certainly makes sense if we can work out the kinks, they said. Perovskite, man, I cannot pronounce that the same way twice.
You're on your own on this one. I can't help Perovskite.
Perovskite. It was some Russian guy that found it, I'm sure. Right. It's considerably cheaper to obtain than process than silicon, and the light-absorbing layer can be increasingly thin, about 1 micrometer at minimum versus at least 180 micrometers for silicon. So I actually read the rest of the article, too. Like I said, it was out on Extreme Tech, and they're taking this stuff that looks like spray paint, and they spray it on a surface, and they connect electrical leads to it, obviously, and it conducts electricity and sends electricity through those electrical leads. So now, obviously, they don't have it perfected yet. It's not as efficient as, say, but they had some percentages in there. It's not as efficient, per se, as a solar panel is today, but they were getting pretty daggum close. Here in the article, they said that traditionally manufactured solar cells based on the mineral have reached as high as 19%, and the spray-on variety is expected to reach similar levels eventually. That might not sound very impressive, but nearly 20% efficiency is rather good for an experimental solar panel. The average efficiency of silicon cells is only 25%. So they're already at, they've already managed to eke out 11% from a thin layer of this stuff. And they're trying to, and they've already gotten it up to as high as 19%. And if they can get to 25%, then that's about the same as a regular solar panel.
That's really cool.
So this brings up the thought: what happens if you spray paint your car with this stuff?
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm no engineer on this. Obviously, they have to worry about weather on this spray paint. Mm-hmm. Can you, like, essentially laminate it? Can you cover it with some sort of a clear coating? Will it still conduct electricity? I mean, obviously, you'd have to still have the metal leads on it. Is this something that'll have to be reapplied? How often will it be reapplied? Like I said, could you put it on your car? Will wind shear degrade? I mean,
it's good questions. I mean, I think it's pretty cool that, you know, they said that now, they said whenever you put it on a curved surface, it decreases the efficiency a little bit.
Makes sense.
But I think it's really cool that they're coming out with this stuff. They're researching this stuff. And, you know, that would be pretty neat if you could, say, for instance, have a cell phone case. A cell phone, for instance, maybe painted with this stuff. And, you're dying on a charge or something like that. You don't have anything to charge it with. And you just end up sticking it in the dash of your car, and it charges itself through, you know, sunlight. But for more bigger stuff though, you know, homes, cars,
the roof,
you know, those kind of things. Now, I mean, if you want solar panels in a home, you have to, you know, for instance, here in Williamsburg, down 25, towards Jellicoe, there's, some homes down there in the Emlyn area that have solar panels up on their roofs. And I mean, it takes up the entire roof, and it, quite honestly, it looks ugly. So I mean, you know, that type of thing could come into play where it wouldn't look quite as bad.
I mean, I've seen obviously, it was just some sort of experimental tech where people put a solar panel, or like a little, very, very small solar panel on like a backpack. Of course, it looks really, really dorky, but, you know, I mean, I could see applications there. I don't know how handy it would be or how cool it would be.
Well, I mean, if they can get a thin layer of this stuff to get up to 25% efficiency, then can they make, you know, other stuff more efficient? Can they make a different type of layer of it, or a thicker layer more efficient? You know, at one micrometer, I mean, that's very small. So
crazy small.
That's pretty exciting, actually. So I thought that was an interesting article.
That's very interesting. Let's see here. Google spots explicit images of a child in a man's email and tips off the police. There's a Slashdot article, Mr. Spoonsy, writes that this story about a tip sent by police to police by Google after scanning a user's email. A Houston man has been arrested after Google sent a tip to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children saying the man had explicit images of a child in his email, according to Houston police. The man was a registered sex offender, convicted of sexually assaulting a child in 1994, reports Tim Wetzel at KHOU Channel 11 News in Houston. Quote, he was keeping it inside of his email. I can't see that information. I can't see that photo, but Google can, Detective David Nettles of Houston Metro Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force told Channel 11. After Google reportedly tipped off the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, the center alerted police, which used the information to get a warrant. I
actually listened to Tom Merritt's Daily Tech News Show podcast yesterday. And him and his guests were talking about this, and you know, it's kind of two sides of the coin,
privacy, and you know, getting the bad guy.
Exactly, and I mean, from the information that I've looked up on this incident with this guy, it looks to me like Google took all the right steps that they were supposed to take. Now, you know, that I guess that's a matter of a personal opinion about what your thoughts are on that, but. I mean, you know, obviously this type of issue is a hot button issue, hopefully with anybody and everybody, that should make you feel like, yes, we want this guy taken care of.
Right.
And I think that's pretty much the case across the board. But again, like you said, the question is, you know, what, you know,
where's
Google
the
saw this in a Gmail email. So, I mean, this wasn't, you know, just somewhere floating around out there. This was in this guy's email.
I don't know. I try to think of, as an IT professional, you know, you're typically, at most institutions, most groups, whatever, you're not supposed to go looking for trouble. If it happens to pop up on something, and then you have, like, your superior's okay, you can investigate it. But typically, you know, I mean... Did it just happen to pop up on something? Is this something that's continually trawling for images? I mean, does Google see where all the sex offenders are, registered sex offenders, and, you know, instantly, like, trawl through their stuff?
I don't have any articles to support this, but my understanding, I don't have them right in front of me, but my understanding of this is that Google keeps, when there's an image in an email, that image is in zeros and ones. Okay, it's in bits.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, your computer translates it back into an image, but it's digital data. So Google keeps profiles of images that would be considered risky, I guess.
Explicit.
That's a better word for it. And they keep profiles of those images, and obviously in zeros and ones.
Scan them, compare
them. And they match them. They try to match them up. And then from my understanding, again, if they match them up, then that gets sent to a U.S. or European agency, depending upon where it is. It gets sent to an agency, and then that agency has someone sitting in front of a computer that actually looks at that and says, okay, this is kosher or this is explicit.
Right.
And so that's my understanding of the process.
That makes sense.
So, you know.
Now, we do know Google regularly but uses algorithms to display ads based on what's, say, in your email, web searches, everything else. So This isn't like any new thing. They have access to your email. Of course, it's their email servers. They have access to whatever they want. But so, I mean, that makes sense. I kind of wish I'd thought of that.
Well, and I mean, once again, I think we say this about 20 times on every show, but anytime that you place information online, that information is public, whether you like it or not. And I mean, in this case, I'm glad that this guy got caught.
Yeah.
You know, the missing and exploited children, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, got tipped off by Google, and then they alerted the police after they checked out the information, and this guy got nabbed, and I think that's great. But, you know, the question is, you know, what happens if somebody sends an explicit image to my Gmail account? You know, do I get nabbed, you know, for that, even though that they it was sent to me? You know, so, and I realize that Google has the ability to look and see, okay, you know, somebody hacked your account, somebody sent this to you that doesn't normally send you email. But still, I mean, this type of charge, and obviously this guy had a history of it, but this type of charge is something that can ruin somebody's life.
Absolutely. Yeah. If I read correctly, I think it was someone on Reddit. This happened to somebody. They got an email, an image somehow that was explicit, and they immediately, you know, closed it, whatever, went to the police, turned over everything, said, this is what I got, and they were fine. They said, okay, they'd investigated and saw, you know, he was totally okay. He right. said they saw he only had it open for a little while, only was like, oh, this is bad, closed it, you know. So I reckon there are protections in place for people that this happens to, I guess right. is a good way of putting it.
And, I mean, I guess that's another point for our listeners as well is, you know, if you get an email that, you know, first of all, never, ever, ever open an email or a link or an attachment from an unknown sender. So, you know, if you get an email from some address or some person that you don't know, even if it looks valid, don't open it. You know, if it's from a particular business, then call the business and say, hey, I just got an email from you. Is this legit? You know, is this really an email that you meant to send me? And if they say, well, yeah, it is, we've been sending those out, then open it. If not, then, you know, delete that email, get rid of it. So, I mean, you know, it's just another time to remind folks to not just willy-nilly open up things that you don't know what they are. Moving on, Engadget article about the NFL, and I like football, not as much as I like basketball, but I like football. But the article starts off and says, are you ready for some football? We should have played the song. Because Microsoft most certainly is, to go along with the introduction of a new NFL app for Xbox One and Windows 8, the software giant has also revealed how it plans to help professional coaches and players during games. As part of an ongoing partnership with the National Football League, which began last year and was reportedly worth $400 million over the past 5 years, or over 5 years, I'm sorry, Microsoft created what it calls a sideline viewing system. Naturally, the company's own hardware is a key component to this. The new system is powered by the Surface Pro 2 tablets, and it allows NFL teams to review plays instantly on the sidelines and go up and up in the booths. So, for instance, I was trying to put example and instance together. Say the quarterback goes to the bench, and the Surface can then be used to see the opposing team's defensive formation during the most recent drive. And the same goes for the coaching staff that keeps an eye on the game from higher ground up in the booth. Players are also able to draw on the images, making it easier for other members of the team to see something which stands out and needs to be checked. While the new system has the potential to replace paper-printed materials on the sideline, that's not what Richmond-based Microsoft hopes to accomplish, at least not yet. Sideline viewing system won't be required to be utilized on NFL teams, but they will all have it at their disposal week in and week out should they choose to integrate it into their workflow. A representative from Microsoft told Engadget the company doesn't want to force anything, adding that ultimately it's up to the individual players and coaches to figure out what they want to do and use the methods best suited for them.
Hmm.
So I thought it was a pretty cool article. I mean, the Engadget article out there showed they have like these little boxes that they roll around that's got all these Surface Pro 2 tablets in them. And they've got some sort of funky case on them. Like it wraps, you can just stick your hand up through the back of it. It's kind of like a, you know, and they could just sit there and hold it on their hand and look at it and draw on it. And it's in a pretty padded,
tough,
protective, tough case. And supposedly, I mean, it's going to, according to this article, it's going to be available for all the games this year. So it'd be interesting to see if, you know, they start to use it.
That is a market I would have never thought about.
It's pretty cool. And now, obviously, you know, they do it on their on NFL's own private network, and each team has their own private network, so one team can't look at the other stuff. Although
it'd be hilarious.
Although, you know, it'd be really smart for a team to hire a hacker.
What's that guy over there do? He gets us our plays.
He's the water boy. Wink, wink.
That's pretty cool. I mean, I would have never thought of this market. I mean, wow.
I'm actually tuned into some football games this year to watch other than for the reason of doing fantasy football.
Now, did you see the? Did you see the? There was an ad for Microsoft in the cloud for business. Cloud for business. I think of what the slogan, whatever it was, and it had. I think it was a Formula One team. Michael Schumacher, maybe. They're going through, he's racing, they see all these guys, they're holding Surface tablets or computers, and it's Microsoft Dynamics for the cloud, for business. And they said you can use it for with over 200 points of data, and they showed some graphs and stuff, and I mean, it looked pretty cool, it was pretty slick commercial, but I guess, you know, Microsoft has always had, or Windows, I should say, has always had, you know, businesses, you know, for years. And, you know, there was a big push for after Apple released the iPad. You know, everyone wants to get iPads, you know, in their hands, do their work on it. And I guess now Apple, not Apple, Microsoft is finally thinking, well, maybe we could use some mobile devices, infrastructure, whatever, in sports. I don't know, whatever else they're doing, entertainment. So I'm good for
them.
Well,
and remember who the new CEO is as well.
Very true. Cloud
Nadella,
is his thing.
Nadella came from cloud, and he's going to push cloud. So, yeah.
Makes sense.
I'm ready for some football.
Planes can be hacked via in-flight Wi-Fi, says a researcher. Let's see. In a presentation to be shown Thursday at the Black Hat Conference, cybersecurity consultant Ruben Santamarta is expected to outline...
Go with those names again.
how planes can be hacked via in-flight Wi-Fi. Representatives of in-flight communication systems confirmed his findings, but downplayed the risks, noting that physical access to the hardware would still be needed and only the communication system would be affected. Well, in my opinion, communication is pretty important. Let's say you could...
On a plane? Who needs communication?
Let's say you could, you could hack into a plane's Wi-Fi and say... I mean, just hypothetically, I'm just now thinking of this. A terrorist hacks into the Wi-Fi, sits, I don't know, in the bathroom with a laptop and... makes themselves out to be ground control and says land at such and such airstrip, and they do, and they just smash into another plane. You know, when they, it was my, that particular landing strip or whatever isn't open. I mean, runway is the word I'm looking for. I mean that's still very dangerous. Communication is very important when you're flying very big things.
I would like to go to the Black Hat Conference one time. I've heard that it'll scare the living daylights out of you. Because, I mean, there's all these people there that talk about how you can hack or,
anything.
Excuse me, crack pretty much anything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've heard that when you go, you just have to be prepared to realize. And from what I heard this the other day, and I don't know if this is true or not. I didn't research it. But I heard that everything there is a cash-only transaction.
That makes sense.
Because... obviously, all you know, people there have the ability to crack things, and some of them are good people, and some of them aren't. But most of the people at Black Hat, their objective is to get this information out so that people will fix it, not to get the information out so that people will crack it. But yeah,
I've heard of people that will hack a business's, well, I should say, crack a business's. I don't know, any of their data, database, anything like that. And then they'll go to the business and say, I have broken into your system. Here's how I did it. Pay me for this. And there are people that have been hired on the spot. There's also people that have tried to seek legal action against them. But
and ransomware.
Right. Yeah, that's another one, too.
Yeah.
Now, we should say the difference between hacking and cracking.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Hacker is a person who is proficient with computers and or programming to an elite level where they know all the ins and outs of a system. There's no illegal, theoretically, there's not supposed to be any illegal activity involved with being a hacker. Originally, it came from, this is before mainframes really big, people would hack things. They threw this good hack together, that they would hack this system together. There was no negative connotations. Cracking is like, you know, not all, it's safe to say that all crackers are hackers, but not all hackers are crackers. Like, cracking is malicious hacking, I guess, is the best way to put it. We're going to go off here for a while.
You said crackers on the radio.
Well, I'm talking legitimately.
The next article. No.
But honestly, cracking is illegal or illegitimate hacking. So I'm done for a while. Your turn.
Yeah. So that's exactly why sometimes you'll hear us talk about hacking and sometimes you'll hear us talk about cracking. Cracking's bad. Hacking's good. Engadget article about wearables. Whatever you think of LG's G-Watch, it has a flaw that gets under your skin a little too literally. Wearers have noticed that its charging pins maintain a current even when they're on a sweaty wrist, triggering corrosion, skin irritation, and even minor burns. Ooh. Thankfully, some relief is at hand. LG and Google have confirmed to Android police that they're rolling out an over-the-air fix which turns off the current unless the Android Wear gadget is sitting on its charging cradle. I've said something to make Kurt laugh.
I want to be on the Android police. I put this watch on. I can feel it. I'm sorry.
You had too much sugar today. The companies say that only a small number of G-Watches produce the problem, so your arm isn't likely to be in danger. However, it's safe to say the patch can't come soon enough. It's not often that code can damage both people and their devices. So, obviously, there's got to be a way to charge the thing. You charge it with these contacts on the back of the watch that sit in the dock, and somebody forgot to turn them off in the code when they're not on the dock. So,
honestly, this is probably one of those oversight things where a programmer just like either didn't think about it and it went through the door, or they thought about it and the project manager said, we don't need that. That'll never happen. Honestly, that's the way some devices that get released work, you know. I'd still have this image of a little droid with like a little police, like,
I mean, that's light siren. That's like Exchange. When Exchange first came out, Exchange 2013 came out.
Yeah.
It wouldn't work with Exchange 2010. It wouldn't work with Office 365. So if you had Exchange 2013 by itself installed in your environment and didn't have any other Exchange servers or systems, then you were fine. If you tried to connect it to anything else, it wouldn't work. And so, I mean, you're right. I mean, sometimes I think the push is there from sales and marketing.
Get it out the door.
Get it out the door, and it may not quite be ready yet. Mm. And I don't know if that's what happened here or not, but somebody... Some bodies paid for it by burnt
wrist. Bodies. I'm just going to be honest before this article. I'm not a big fan of Sony. Ever since the whole rootkit incident that happened, I mean, this was like over a decade ago, I'm sure, where you put an audio CD in and it would put a rootkit on your computer to scan for other media or illegally obtained. I forgot exactly how it worked. Basically sent usage data back to Sony. You don't ever think about it because, you know, nobody remembers it. And, you know, whoever's Sony's PR, they must be, like, almost as good as Apple's PR. But anyway, so I'm going to get on Sony here. Sony tosses the Sony reader on the scrap heap. Did you even know they had an e-reader?
No.
I didn't either. Well, it's gone now. So Sony's decided to follow up closing its e-book stores in the U.S. and Europe by getting out of the consumer e-book reader market entirely.
Oh, e-book stores in the U.S.? They had e-book stores in, like, the U.S.?
I didn't even get into it. I was just glad to see something bad on Sony.
Oh, okay. I've never heard of this before.
I haven't.
Please
been
continue.
Data. The current model, the Sony Reader PRS-T3, will be sold until stock runs out, and Sony won't be releasing a new model. This is a sad end for what used to be a pioneering company. Yeah. This gadget maker might not have made the first ebook reader, but it was the first to use the paper-like e-ink screen. Now, that actually is kind of cool. Having launched the Sony Libri, whatever, in 2004, Sony literally invented the modern ebook reader, and then it went on to release the only 7-inch models to grace the market, as well as the first e-reader to combine a touchscreen and front light, the Sony Reader PRS-700. Unfortunately, Sony couldn't come up with software or an ebook retail site which matched their hardware genius. So even though Sony released amazing hardware, it had losing ground to Amazon, B&N, and other retailers ever since the Kindle launched in 2007. So I guess this is an issue where somebody releases hardware and they can't back it up with the software or market to get it going.
Sony is an interesting company. I mean, obviously, I mean, okay, I like Sony
good
just because I'll be the devil's advocate here. I like Sony just because, I mean, I think they have a history of good products. I think that, you know, as far as, you know, your home audio, home theater system, I don't think you can get much better than, you know, obviously I know you have Bose and those type of things.
But oh,
I mean,
yeah.
For the normal Joe like me and you, things that we can afford and things that are good quality, I think Sony makes good stuff. You know, Sony always reminds me of this little TV that my dad always had. And, you know, so I have some Sony products at the house. They do me well. I like them. Was this a good market for Sony to get into? Probably not. There's a lot of competition out there. There wasn't at the time, but they just didn't pull it out. And sometimes that happens.
They didn't keep up with the needs of the consumers or with foreseeing where the consumers would need to go.
Yeah. And that happens sometimes.
Maybe one day we'll talk about the rootkit scandal, but that was in 2005, so I don't think anybody will care. There is a list of CDs that would still, if you put it in your computer, would probably install this rootkit, but I don't know. It doesn't really matter now. I don't know. I just didn't like that. So, sorry about that. Moving on.
Kurt doesn't like Sony. Moving on. Engadget article about XBMC. Now, XBMC stands for Xbox Media Center.
Ooh.
Okay. And that term really isn't relevant anymore. That was a term that started whenever Xbox was very young.
The original Xbox.
Exactly. The Media Center app only runs on the original Xbox through hacks. And it does a lot more than play music and videos. So it's getting a long overdue rebranding, and it's going to be called I assume they're calling it Kodi. I assume that's the way they're going to pronounce it.
Works for me.
The Kodi Entertainment Center. It's a moniker you'll see from version 14 onward. The new name is more universal and less prone to legal issues since the old one had Xbox in it. The developers now have control over their own trademark, and that should prevent trouble with other companies, no doubt including Microsoft, that might send lawyers and after fans or the XBMC team itself. The first Kodi release is a rough alpha, so don't expect to see the new name everywhere just yet. Hmm. However, it shouldn't be long before XBMC badging it's consigned, or the XBMC badging is consigned to the history books. Now, Kurt, have you used XBMC?
I have done enough to install the Ubuntu version on a laptop, and all I had done was imported music over to it. I wanted to put it on the drive locally, and other than that, I haven't really got a chance to use it yet, so I couldn't sing its praises, but I've heard a lot of good things about it.
I have XBMC at home, and I really like it. I mean, it's a great... you know how you used to have Windows Media Center and actually still have Windows Media Center? It's just... do they still have that in Windows 8?
It may have been rebranded as something else. But
they can still kind of do the same things?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where you'll say run... You'll have videos or whatever on your Xbox, and you can either play it for your computer or... Maybe on a computer and queue it up through the Xbox. So I think it can kind of work both ways. And you could even be playing a game and queue up with songs too, or music and video and stuff. It's kind of cool.
Oh, well, okay.
I would assume.
So they're still doing, you know, Microsoft's still doing that kind of thing. And XBMC is just, it's an open source run off of the way that Xbox used to do the Media Center software. And it's really cool. I mean, you know, if you have some videos that you have access to that are, you know, I would, you know, make sure those are legal and you can use them. But if you have legal access to videos, you can play them on that device and you can connect it to, you know, accounts that you have like Hulu or YouTube or different things like that and use that to store all that stuff and play it on your TV. At home, I have a laptop hooked up to my 46-inch flash screen with an HDMI cable, and that laptop is running OpenELEC, which is running XBMC. So I like XBMC. I'm glad to see them moving forward. I would hate to see them just stop and be like, okay, you know, we're not going to do this anymore because we don't want to get sued.
Right.
You know, they're going to do the right thing here and
transform into something new.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited.
App of the day, maybe.
Yeah, we should do that sometime. Okay. I agree.
Okay. Have you or anyone, I guess, listening, ever got the urge to Google yourself? how Google handles the right to be forgotten requests. This is a big thing in Europe. I don't know why it's bigger there, but an anonymous reader, this is on Slashdot again, in response to an inquiry from European data protection regulators, Google has detailed how they evaluate and act on requests to de-index search results. Google's procedures for responding to the quote-unquote right to be forgotten, or RTBF, these requests are explained in a lengthy document that was made publicly available. Google, of course, claims its own economic interest does not come into play when making these RTBF judgments, beyond an abstract consideration of a search engine needing to help people find the most relevant information for their query. Google also goes into lengthy detail to justify its decision to inform publishers when it has removed links to content on their sites, a decision which has resulted in media outlets writing new articles about delisted content, thereby resulting in the RTBF ruling causing the opposite effect to that intended, i.e. fresh publicity, not fair obscurity. What's that, the is it called the Streisand effect? Where I think the Google Street View cars were going through and took pictures of basically their front door. Mm-hmm. Basically their house, that house where she was living. And they found out about it. And in the process of saying, hey, remove this, or hey, this is a lawsuit to remove this, it got more publicity than if she just ignored it. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's called the Streisand effect. And that's essentially what's happening at the end of this article here. But
so one of our listeners right now actually just sent us a tweet and said, I make my journalism students Google themselves and see what shows up. Any potential employer will do it. So, you know, that's a good point there, Jeremiah, that you're exactly right. Employers will go out and look for what's posted about you and what you've posted about yourself online.
Social. We should really talk about that one day.
Yeah, I mean, you know, social media, what a person puts about themselves online is extremely important. And again, we mentioned this earlier in the show.
It's there forever.
It is. It's there forever, and there's no privacy to it. You know, well, I shared this to my friends. That doesn't matter. I mean, if you shared it to your friends and your friends can take that picture, download it to your machine and repost it somewhere else. So you've shared it to everyone anytime you share anything online. And, you know, here, you know, again, Jeremiah makes a good point. He includes that to his journalism students and says, hey, you know, go out and run a Google search on yourself and see what comes up. And if, you know, I'm sure that he teaches them that if it's something you don't like, then that's something you should probably think about, you know, because there's a big thing going on right now. And I don't know how many of our listeners have heard about it, but it's this thing of you know, being forgotten. You know, something online about you, having that removed and forgotten. And there's a big push out there about it right now, but it's extremely difficult. You know, once this stuff gets out so far into the internet, how do you delete it from everywhere?
Right.
How do you become forgotten? And it's really hard to do.
Right. Oh, definitely.
And Jeremiah, thanks for that tweet. You know, just keep it in mind as well. At WCCR Tech Talk, you can tweet us anytime during the show and let us know what you think about what we're talking about here on the show. But good stuff, and it's always good for our listeners to comment in.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Network World article, the right to unlock your cell phone has become law. As of Friday, President Obama signed a bill that rapidly passed both houses of Congress. The Unlocking Consumer Choice and Wireless Competition Act passed the Senate on July 16th and was unanimously approved by the House of Representatives last Friday. Obama had been expecting it, to sign it, had been expected to sign it. The law restores U.S. consumers' rights to update the software on their phones so that they may change their mobile operators. That practice has been outlawed by a January 2013 decision by the Library of Congress, which ruled that consumer unlocking violated the DMCA, or Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Most cell phones sold in the U.S. come with built-in software that locks the phone so it can be used on only one carrier's network. The Library of Congress has found that changing that software violated the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA, which are typically deployed against cracking of digital rights management technology. There's that word again that we talked about earlier.
Cracking.
The law just signed is good news for customers of AT&T and T-Mobile. which use the same network technology, so phones can be easily switched over if unlocked. It also benefits international travelers who want to buy a service from foreign carriers instead of roaming, which is typically more expensive. However, there is a catch to the new law. Its exemption to the DMCA will expire in 2015 when the Library of Congress is due to make another ruling on the subject. So it's going to come up again. So it's not just like, okay, this is forever. This is going to come up again. And,
Interesting.
Once again, you know, if you purchase a cell phone and you pay for that cell phone, then that should be your cell phone to use how you like. That's just my personal opinion. I think it's good that people have the ability to switch carriers. I think that drives up competition. I think that increases our wonderful state of capitalism, and I like it.
Well, playing devil's advocate here, you buy a cell phone from me, and you expect me to support it and do, you know, help you out with any problems you may have with it. And, you know, I'm investing almost in a sense in you to keep paying me, basically. And then you decide just up and leave. I'm a little hurt. And if more and more people do this, you know, let's say there's something I can't compete with. Either A, I do agree, actually, you know, they're going to have to just fight to keep you. But that's something I don't like. And I'm going to do everything in my power to keep that phone on my network. So
I you're like that Comcast guy that wouldn't shut up about wanting his customer.
That's my phone. Keep my phone.
I love it when you play devil's advocate.
Yeah, it's fun.
So that's it for our article roundup there. What do we call that? Tech roundup. That's what we call it. And so now we're going to move on to app of the week. So app of the week this week is an iOS app, and I actually they have it for Android too, and I don't know, Kurt, if they have it for Windows mobile phone.
I didn't
look it up, but it's called Scanner Radio Deluxe. So I know there's some people out there who like to keep up with police scanners, CB stations, and things like that. So you know, if you're a ham radio operator, or if you just, you know, like to listen to policemen key up on their radio every once in a while. Scanner Radio Deluxe is the name of the app, and Kurt's shaking his head.
I'm seeing a ton of 911 scanner, police scanner, scanner radio, police scanner 7, but not Scanner Radio Deluxe.
So Scanner Radio Deluxe is a free app from the iOS store and also for the Google Play store. And it's got I downloaded this week a trooper friend of mine showed it to me.
Really?
And locally here up in London in Laurel County, you can listen to the Laurel County police and EMS and fire. You can listen and also the station up there for the state troopers goes over their lines as well. So you can listen to that. The app gives you the ability to turn on alerts. So people who track these stations, they'll put out an alert. And so, like, if there's a big fire somewhere, say, you know, some other city, or you can turn on specific alerts for only favorites or for all of them. And then you can listen, you know, it'll say there's a big fire in Chicago, you know, and you can turn to that station and it'll, you can hear all the radio stuff that's going on with the emergency services over that.
It's almost like rubbernecking for radio. It's kind of cool.
So I've been playing around with it a little bit this week, and, you know, I thought it was a pretty cool app. But, again, you can search for it on the Google Play Store and on iOS App Store. It's Scanner Radio Deluxe. And
that's pretty cool. I mean, I guess I never really got into this exactly, but, you know, I'd go to, I think, as usually a grandparents' house. They're much more interested in, you know, locally what's going on, you know, always listen to the scanner, and I always thought it was a little odd, but now that I'm you know, moved out from my parents' house, I'm a little more interested if there's something going on near me, so that, you know, I guess I might look into this.
So it's good to keep up with what's going on. So again, Scanner Radio Deluxe, you can look that up on the App Store or on Google Play. And that's it for App of the Week. Let's move into our deep dive. Starting off this week's deep dive, Network World article. reads that Facebook is reporting increased errors. This was on August 1st, by the way. On all of its platforms, as users in the U.S. report, the social network has been down since about noon Eastern. And keep in mind, this is an article from the 1st of August, but we're going to talk a little bit about it. Users began to complain that the site was unavailable or slow to load at best early this afternoon. As of 12:45 Eastern time, the problem persisted, though the site has briefly been accessible for some users, quickly crashing again. So Facebook went down, and then an interesting article that came up in PC Magazine said that some folks actually started calling 911 in Los Angeles. There was a Los Angeles Sergeant Brink, and he posted on Twitter and said, "Facebook is not a law enforcement issue. Please don't call us about it being down. We don't know when FB will be back up." And then somebody said, "You know, are you getting a lot of calls about it?" And he went back to his Twitter account and said, "Yes, we got a lot of calls Facebook down, hashtag Facebook down. That is why I sent out my previous message to prevent them. Unknown number received on 911 or regular number." And so...
Oh my goodness!
People were calling in to 911 saying that Facebook was down.
I hope this isn't our generation.
So, you know, question, Kurt. Instead of calling 911, what troubleshooting steps could our listeners use to tell if they have a local connectivity issue or a site down on the other end?
Well, first off, can you load a site other than Facebook? Then, if you can load a site other than Facebook, go to a website like Is It Down or Just Me? I think it's .com. I better check that before I say that on the air. But
So you know,
Is It Down for Everyone or Just Me? So this actually website's called DownForEveryoneOrJustMe.com. You can go there, type in Facebook.com, and it will check for you. If that doesn't work. I can't even like think straight.
Oh, you know, it's interesting that people will typically, like, for instance, if they're at a business and Facebook goes down, then automatically they blame their IT department and say, "Okay, the IT department has blocked us from Facebook." Well, that may not be the case. I mean, Facebook may have just went down. I mean, Facebook is a service just like anything else, and I mean,
it is fallible.
Yeah, they can have technical problems too.
It's not perfect. There are people that work there, like actual people.
So, I mean, I found this. I was interested that Facebook went down. I mean, anytime a big...
That's huge.
It's huge whenever somebody goes down like that. And they said here, they said, "Facebook is currently experiencing an issue that is affecting all API and web surfaces." So, essentially, it says here they had an increased rate of errors for the Graph API today. "We reverted the change that caused the issue, and we're sorry for any inconvenience caused." So, it sounds like they were doing some sort of an update on one of their APIs, which an API is just a it's a piece of code that
application programming interface. Typically, let's say I have some sort of product or service, I'll write an API for other developers to use and interface with my stuff directly so that we don't have to write all the code for every single person. So
bingo. Yeah, right, nail on the head, Kurt. That's
sorry
exactly
to interrupt
what it is. No, that's exactly what it is. And so, you know, but the reason I put it in the deep dive again, though, is just because these people are calling 911.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, 911 when Facebook is down.
I mean, all right, what does 911 do? You're listening to your nice scanner, and you've got, I don't know, fire, domestic dispute, I don't know, burglary, theft. I can't even think of... I don't know, any kind of emergency that an emergency service can deal with. Not an internet outage or even a server down.
I can only imagine what they had to say, something along the lines of, 911, you know, and, "Well, Facebook is down. Can you have the police go check and make sure their servers haven't got stolen?"
Oh, my goodness. I mean, no offense. Not everyone has the technical knowledge that... You know, not everyone has that technical knowledge. It's not something that someone working at a dispatch center was going to need to know. I'd like to know how they would feel that. And he's like, you know what?
Don't call 911.
I want to say don't call 911, but what if you have an actual emergency?
Yeah, I mean, that's just the type of thing you don't call 911 for.
Now, that's not anything new. I've had some friends that work in dispatch centers, and they'll get calls for the dumbest things. You know, I think I heard a call that there someone's teeth were missing. They'd misplaced them, and they were calling because they wanted help to find them. And it's like, that's gross misuse of that. And that I think that is an offense you can get arrested for. I'm not sure exactly what that fits under, but, oh, goodness. Is this our generation? Is this us? Is this
it's not me.
You're maybe, in with me.
maybe it's our generation in California, but it's not me.
Oh, goodness.
So, I mean, you know, for our listeners out there, if you're going out to any site, like it's Facebook or anything else, I mean, you know, first of all, you can't get to the site. First of all, you want to determine, you know, am I having a local computer problem, or am I having, you know, or is the site down on the other end? You know, and like Kurt said, first of all, see if you can get to another site. Mm-hmm. If you can, then more than likely that site's having some trouble. Give it some time and then try it again.
Yeah. Like I said, there's a website, Is It Down or Just Me, that kind of site, you know, you can check with them. Call someone with another ISP. Call them to see if it's not some weird block on from the ISP level, which is something like Facebook, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you're exactly right. Next step is, you know, if you can't get to that other site, then, you know, restart your computer. Obviously, step one, you know, restart the router and the modem, whatever connects to your cable modem or your DSL line. And if that doesn't work, you know, call your internet service provider and say, hey, you know, I can't get to, and maybe it's three or four sites you can't get to. You know, the internet, it routes things. So, I mean, think of when you go to a website, think of it as, you know, calling a telephone number. I mean, it's essentially the same thing. When you type in google.com, you're going out to an address, and that address is kind of the same thing as a telephone number. It's contacting a server, and you know, if there's an issue in the route back to that server, so if you know, if there is a route that's down, you know, for instance, if you're trying to drive from here to my house and there is a tree down somewhere, then you're going to have problems taking that route to get there. You may have to take an alternate route. You may have to take a, you know, you may have to stop there and not be able to get through for a while. So it's kind of the same thing when you get to go to a site on the internet. If there's a router that's down somewhere that's not passing traffic properly, then, you know, that needs to, you need to keep that in mind, and that may keep you from getting to the site you're trying to get to, or it may take longer to get to that site because you're having to route around that problem. But, you know, don't call 911.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, still. Ow.
So we spent a lot of time in our tech roundup today, and so that's going to end up for our deep dive today as well. And I think we're just going to, for the sake of time, skip tech and numbers as well and just go right on to Goofy Tech.
This music every single time. We just let it play, you know?
Just play through the whole show.
All 46 seconds.
So on The Verge this week, Kurt usually finds our Goofy Tech, but I found this one, and Kurt, I thought, would like this. Feel free to read it if you want to. But Zach Danger Brown of Ohio took to Kickstarter a month ago with a humble goal in mind. He wanted $10 so he could make potato salad. He hadn't yet decided on the specific ingredients, but okay, let's back up. Kickstarter. Okay.
All right, what is Kickstarter, Justin? Or do you want me to? Okay,
go ahead.
Kickstarter is a way you can, what is known as crowdsource or crowdfund a project. And there are some guidelines for Kickstarter, and they've definitely changed a lot. It's, let's say I have an idea for a product. I don't know. Let's say you have a widget. I shouldn't go with that one, but you don't want to. You want to go with some product, and you think, "Oh, this is something a lot of people would invest in." Instead of having, I don't know, actual investors with deep pockets, you ask everybody, and they all chip in a few dollars. Hopefully, you get tons of money, and you hopefully in enough time you have a product, a prototype, or whatever. But it's typically for, I don't know, the Ouya. That was a open source video game. That was a big one. Right. It kind of flopped, but still, it's kind of going. We could talk about that one another day, but. That was an example. It was a video game system, open source. That was a semi-successful Kickstarter.
So Zach Brown here wanted $10 so he could make potato salad on Kickstarter.
Obviously, he was kind of joking.
Right.
Kind of.
Right. So it says here he hadn't decided on the specific ingredients beyond the potatoes, and he might never have, but his overt trolling of the most popular crowdfunding platform was picked up by the internet and rapidly overfunded hundreds of times over. The satire had turned to serious by July 7th when more than $30,000 had been pledged. And today, this was last week, the campaign completed with a final total of $55,492 for this guy's potato salad. So here's the cool thing, though. He says he's going to use about $25,000 of it to fulfill the various stretch goals of this project before hosting Potato Stock 2014 Music Festival in late September.
Like what
now,
stock?
proceeds from the concessions at the event, which will be free to attend because of all this money, will go to a local charity. So
nice.
The whole thing started off as a big joke, but it's turning out doing more good than just making people laugh. So
I first saw this on Reddit, and I linked to it, and everyone's going crazy. Like, oh, I want potato salad, too. But, you know, it's probably never going to work again.
Oh,
you know?
No. You know? Well, congrats to Zach Brown. I mean, something fun to do.
That's pretty cool.
Thanks for making us laugh.
Let's see, other successful crowd sources. There's been... you ever hear of Calvin and Hobbes?
Mm-hmm.
There is a documentary on Netflix called Dear Mr. Watterson, I think. That was Kickstarter, if I remember correctly. There's other Kickstarters that are pretty popular. I think the Brony documentary was crowdfunded as well, Kickstarter. What else was there? I don't know. Kickstarter's a really cool idea. That's really, I guess, taken off.
So if you want some mac and cheese, go to Kickstarter. Get it started.
We cannot guarantee that it will work.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to today's show. Don't forget you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/WCCRTechTalk. And on Twitter, obviously, just like Jeremiah did at WCCRTechTalk. Be sure to send us a tweet there, even the Miz show.
That was exciting.
And it was exciting. We can take your comments and suggestions and use them in the show.
That made my day.
That's exactly right. You can also get the podcast of today's show by searching Tech Talk Today on iTunes or just by going and searching for that on our go get that from our Facebook page. And so that's it for me. I'm Justin Hensley.
And I'm Kurt Lawson. Stay with us for this Super Tuesday lineup for Summer 2014 from 7 to 9 as we have the Figure Four Fallout with Russell Ridner, Bo Kidd, Casey Malone, Dustin Harden, and Justin Durbin. Thank you very much. You're listening to WCCR 94.5 LPFM, Williamsburg, Kentucky. You all take care and have a good day.